Call to order. A couple of notes for those of you who may be in the audience on Senate Bill 55. Apparently there are some amendments that essentially change many aspects of Senate Bill 55, and those amendments are not ready for us today. So we are not going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 55, because if you are signed up to testify, you would likely be testifying on something different than what will actually come before the committee, which would not be fruitful for you or the committee. So we will repost that and get back as soon as those are ready. With that, we're going to change our order just a little bit, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 120. Teresa, if you would give us a brief explanation of 120.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 120 does a variety of enhancing investigative and enforcement authority for non-depository programs which are regulated under the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The bill authorizes the director of DCBS to examine conditions and resources of those who are or are acting as certified providers or master trustees of free-range funeral and cemetery services, and to cease and desist orders where appropriate. I can go through the rest of the bill. I think there's people here that can testify.
That's a good synopsis to get us going for our subject matter. And let's see, where's my sign-in sheet here for this bill? You probably out there know who it is that wants to come forward, so why don't you do that while we're getting the sign-up sheet? Tell us. It's a good way to do it. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is David Tatman. On the testimony that's being handed out to you, it says Floyd Lanter.
Recognize you are not him, so.
No, I'm not Floyd. I am the Deputy Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and my name is spelled T as in Tom, A, T again, M-A-N, for the record. I'm here today to testify and answer any questions the committee may have regarding Senate Bill 120. And as the Administrator pointed out, this bill addresses a number of issues within our non-depository program, or as it says within the testimony, NDP. The program is comprised of numerous regulatory programs involving the regulation of financial businesses that do not have the benefit of FDIC insurance, so we call it non-depository. And the purpose behind the bill is to ask that we establish a uniform set of enforcement tools so that we can enforce the laws to the fullest extent possible. And if you turn to the last page of the testimony, you'll see that there's a chart. And I think that's a very simple way to follow through what we're trying to accomplish. On that chart, you will see at the top mortgage lenders. That is a program we regulate. This is not something we're amending today or asking the committee to consider an amendment. But below that are all the various non-depository programs, and you can see the three areas that we were looking into in terms of enforcement powers. One, do we have full authority to issue subpoenas and obtain information? And in many instances, you can see that we do not. Two, do we have the authority to issue cease and desist orders, and that is take administrative action to enforce our laws when we find violations? And again, in many instances, we do not. Can we recover the cost of investigations? And the chart breaks it down for you also. Lastly, and most importantly, I'd like to point out that in some instances, we have all this authority for the various business entities that are licensed with us, but those that choose, or don't choose, but have not licensed with us, we do not have authority over. And we feel like that is the huge hole inside the donut, and we're asking in some instances to have authority over those business entities that are in fact conducting certain businesses but do not have a license. So if the chair and the committee would like, I'm happy to go over the testimony. What we've attempted to do is break it down by the various programs. So if you will, turning to page 2, I would just point out that one of the reasons why the bill, why the language in the various programs looks so different is they've been created at different times with different legislative bodies, and different pieces were brought in at different times, and so it's somewhat sporadic. What we're asking for is a uniform approach so that we can ensure that we are able to enforce the laws fully and make sure that we can do so in a way that protects Oregonians. For instance, starting in the middle of page 2, we talk about the pre-need law, and that is a law where we regulate those that provide funeral services in advance. They receive a fee and they hold the money, and we go out and we conduct examinations and we ensure that that money is safely secured in trust. Well, we've had instances where we need the ability to go in and issue a cease and desist order. One was out of Eugene this past year. It was a problem for us, and so cease and desist order would be a big plus for us in that area, because it's an area obviously where consumers are very concerned once there is a problem. I mean, this is probably the most emotional issue they'll ever have, is the safety and soundness of the money that's been put up for their loved ones at a time when they pass away. So we want the ability to act quickly, such as with a cease and desist order. Other areas would include credit service organization, where we want the ability to issue cease and desist orders, have investigative authority, and take enforcement actions against those who are not registered as credit service organizations. Similarly, we want to do the same for collections agencies. And then there's debt consolidating agencies at the top of page 3. And finally, consumer finance law. Consumer finance is a broad concept. You probably heard generally those are people that are involved with lending to people in terms of non-bank, non-credit union, non-traditional lending, oftentimes called subprime lending, but not necessarily so, and includes payday and title lenders. So it's an area that's very ripe with interest right now, and we think it's important that we make sure we have all the tools at hand to do what we need. Lastly, on page 3, you'll see that there's a reference to pawnbrokers. Now, our pawnbroker law, we think it's adequate. We were here last session to talk about pawnbrokers, and we have continued with the pawnbroker law in place, but what we don't have is authority to go after those that are acting as pawnbrokers, using the name pawnbrokers, but are not licensed as pawnbrokers. And so we think, again, that's a very important component, and we've added that. As I say, it touches on a number of programs. I believe that the summary at the end of the testimony is probably the best way to encapsulate it. This is a fee-neutral bill. We're not aware of any opposition. We've talked with a number of the trade organizations and people that act on behalf of the trade organizations, and we've heard nothing but either support or neutral positions. So we would ask the committee's support for this concept and a do pass recommendation. And I'm happy to answer questions at this time.
Thank you very much. Question, Senator Atkinson.
So in the case of Eugene, you needed a cease and desist order. What did you do?
Chair Metzger and Senator Atkinson, we ultimately didn't take the action, but what we did was we worked through and negotiated a settlement with the party in question. And they were willing to allow us to step in and impose an order that required them to essentially repay the money. And we also worked with the bank in question where the money is being held to make sure the money was returned to the investors.
Okay. Well, so that was one instance of among all these funeral homes and mortgage lenders and collection agencies. I mean, is this a huge problem? I mean, are you looking to get more authority than you already have? What's broken here?
Again, Senator Metzger and Senator Atkinson, my belief is that it just gives us the authority to act. If we don't have that authority, we wouldn't be able to solve these problems.
Another question, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Sir.
So are you going to come back next session and ask for an increase in FTEs to go out and monitor all these companies?
No, sir, we won't be doing that.
Okay. Well, I still don't understand why we need more government regulation in the business. Just because. I'm sorry, I just don't understand why we need it.
Well, again, Chair Metzger,
we're giving you tools, but I mean, we're this legislature's really good at giving government tools. We don't seem to give business tools that often. I mean, help me. Am I just on low blood sugar or something here? What, I don't understand. What's the problem?
Again, Chair Metzger and Senator Atkinson, it's my belief that if we're charged with making sure these things are done properly, and we are charged with going in and examining, for instance, the pre-need industry, and if we find violations and we're unable to take anything type of action to enforce it, then we've been given charge over overseeing something, but then there's nothing we can do at the back end. And I don't think that we're fulfilling our mandate on behalf of the consumers. I mean, I guess we could go in and file a lawsuit, but at that point, a lawsuit is an extremely protracted and expensive process where we think the administrative process of a cease and desist order allows us to get in there, and if there's an immediate problem that needs to be fixed, we can get it fixed.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Scarf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following up on Senator Atkinson's questions, the, is my understanding correct that that the folks that you're attempting to get for additional authority as it relates to this bill are folks that aren't licensed but ought to be licensed, should be licensed? Is that the situation? So these folks are out there operating their business, supposed to be licensed with DCBS, but aren't. And if they were, then you would have the authority, but since they're not, you don't, so you're going to ask for the authority to get the folks that should be licensed. Wouldn't it be better if that's, I guess if that's the problem, wouldn't it be better to just go out and make sure these folks that are supposed to be licensed get licensed?
Chair Metzger and Senator Starr, I agree with you. First of all, in certain instances, we don't have, as for instance in the pre-need area, we do not have the authority currently for cease and desist authority. So we don't have the authority over the licensees or if there was such a thing as an unlicensed pre-need person. But in other situations, it's exactly as you described. We're dealing with people that aren't licensed. For instance, we had a situation in Klamath County, I think it was Klamath Falls, where someone was a pawnbroker. They were using the word pawn in their name. They weren't licensed as a pawnbroker, and we did just what you described. We went to them and said, you have to be licensed, and they ultimately got the license. And we didn't take additional action. But there are times where people may feel like they don't either need to respond to us, or more importantly, they may not be willing to give us the information necessary for us to figure out what's going on. Without the subpoena authority, I'll have to be honest with you, the enforcement aspect is as much a deterrent as the actual cease and desist order. But if we can go in and get information and figure out what's going on, we may determine that this is something we can resolve, as you say, by getting them licensed. Or we may discover that this is an intended fraud with money leaving the state or something like that. So there are different scenarios, but without the ability to have enforcement authority over these non-licensees, if you will, that we are really hamstrung in our ability to protect people, we think.
I think, members, I think one of the issues here, and I think it's articulated, is that, and as we've contacted some of the organizations, is you do have those in situations where people aren't licensed, and of course they're competing with legitimate businesses and doing these kinds of activities. And while you may be able to take court action, as I think as the witness has said, it's protracted. In the meantime, these other businesses are being preyed upon essentially for business which they are conducting legally. I think in the case of the Eugene, unfortunately that worked out for those individuals, but in the meantime, had that not been cooperative, it could have been a negative impact if you couldn't have come in and immediately put a freeze on those activities. So I think that's what we're trying to get at. I don't see it as, you know, adding new rules, but making sure that everybody is competing fairly. If they're an unlicensed payday lender, make sure that those who are following the rules and knew what they're supposed to be doing aren't allowed to participate and simply hold out for a court action or for the fact where the public is really at risk. I think that could be significant too. Questions? Any further questions for this witness? Senator Montesander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a fiscal on this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, we don't believe there will be. We think we have the enforcement authority, we have the enforcement staff to handle this right now. We don't see any FTEs coming in. We don't see any increase in terms of our need to put in additional positions. So we think it will be fee neutral.
Great question. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Decker.
Thank you. So how prevalent is this? Is the Eugene case and the pawnbroker, and I forget what city that was, is that an isolated example, or is this pretty prevalent across Oregon where you have unlicensed businesses doing business, competing with licensed businesses?
Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, it would depend on the area. I would say in the pawnbrokering area, it's not uncommon. We have a number of people, and frankly, just as the chair said, a lot of people that have gotten a license are somewhat frustrated when they find that there are others not subject to that license doing the same thing. And so we get a lot of people complaining to us, and with the limitations in staff and questions about our authority, we have to go fairly gingerly how we proceed with that. So in that area, I'd say, I can't give you a percentage, but I can tell you that probably there are more people that are unlicensed that engage in consignment selling than there are people licensed as pawnbrokers. In the pre-need area, there probably aren't a lot of people that are engaged in non-licensed conduct, but we're also trying to make sure we have cease and desist authority over those people. So
Mr. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead. At
all. But are we talking 10, 20 cases or 200 cases?
Senator Decker, I can't tell you exactly how many there would be in the pawnbrokering area, but I would guess it's certainly over several quarters. But as I say, I'm told not to guess, so what I can do is come back and try and give you hard numbers. We may have that back at the office. We obviously don't keep statistics of people that should be licensed but aren't, but we probably have some sense of that.
Thanks.
Okay. Questions? Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Amy Lowry. Welcome.
Thank you. Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Amy Bowman Lowry, and I am a funeral home owner from Dallas, Oregon, and legislative chair for the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. I would like to lend my support to this bill. We had thought we wanted to take a little time and hear a little more about it and see if we had any issues with it, and we really don't. In the 2001 legislative session, the Oregon Funeral Directors Association worked with a number of other stakeholders to create House Bill 2809, which transferred the regulatory authority for pre-need trusts from the Secretary of State's office to DCBS. We worked with the agency, consumers, master trustees, and put into place a number of requirements that were imposed on us to strengthen how we write trusts and how we take care of consumers that come in that want to put their funds to prearranged funerals. We have more steps that we have to take now to do this, and we felt that it was a very good thing and a good thing for the consumer. One thing that's very important to us is that the cases that we hear about from Eugene and elsewhere, that those go away and these cases don't happen anymore. And one of the ways we want to do that is by having proper regulation in place. I'm certainly not one that is asking for more regulation on my business, but I also want consumer protections in place. And I think this bill is a very good tool for also expanding the requirements to those that aren't currently registered. I think there are some businesses out there that may be offering prearranged services that don't go through a master trustee and use other forms to do that. And I think this legislation would give DCBS the tools to look at anyone in the state that is offering prearranged funeral services to consumers and take a look at how they are financing those and what protections are in place. So I am in support of this. Our association is in support, and we would be perfectly fine if it passed out of the committee today.
Thank you, Ms. Lowry. Questions for Ms. Lowry? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lantner? I see has entered the room.
Yes.
So, Mr. Lantner, a couple of members had some questions about the need for the cease and desist orders on the spectrum that we have before us today, and any particular insight that you could provide to us. We just had, as you heard, Ms. Lowry talk about in support of the Funeral Directors Association, but you may have heard some other questions that Senator Atkinson and Senator Starr also had about whether this was necessary and how prevalent our problems have been with people who are competing unfairly with other licensed businesses.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Floyd Lantern. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities within the Department of Consumer Business Services. And we are talking about Senate Bill 120, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I just got through testifying down the hall here. The issue is being able to apply consistent enforcement across our program. Just to give you a little bit of background, finance and corporate securities in the non-deposit area, the area that we're talking about here today. When I say non-deposit, I'm talking about financial service providers that do not take or accept or operate with insured deposits. So they range from mortgage lenders to collection agencies to pre-need funeral plans, credit service providers, etc. And what we've tried to do within the division is to achieve a consistent enforcement philosophy, because these programs have been transferred to the division or the department over the years, and as a result, there are a series of legislative accruements, if you will, of the enforcement powers and statutory requirements within these statutes. And so in order to enforce, to have a consistent enforcement approach, process, as such, we looked at the different authorities that we have in these programs, and we said, if we can level the field, if you will, we can apply this much more consistently and protect consumers more effectively, rather than relying on what currently exists in the statutes.
Mr. Lander, one of the specific questions, and I know you may not have, you know, the data right in front of you, but that a number of members asked was, you know, how pervasive the problems are in which these tools might be utilized across the spectrum of businesses.
Chair Metzger, yes, let me. I've got a number of examples here, right here in front of me. I'll just provide them to the committee. I would preface my remarks in that the primary issue is operating in an unlicensed manner. That's the biggest complaint we get in general. We don't have the authority to go after these folks. But that said, in the pre-needs, we've had referrals from the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board, which shares responsibilities for the supervision and administration of this area. And we've written letters with no response, and since we have no subpoena power or cease and desist authority, we can't do anything about it. So, credit service organization area, primarily unregistered entities again. We had a referral from the city of Medford and two that came across the internet. Same issue, letters written, no response. No subpoena power or cease and desist authority, so I had to leave it at that. Debt consolidation agency, we've had multiple referrals here from the Department of Justice and private attorneys, and we've had a number of consumer complaints as well. Phone messages and letters have resulted in either no response or denial that the law exists. So, we have no cease and desist authority again or authority to collect costs or recover our costs of any investigation. The consumer finance area, primarily unlicensed entities. We've had referrals from police and referrals from other licensed entities who see this as a competition issue, obviously. And we've had a couple of consumer complaints in the past year as well. And again, the same problem or issue. We write a letter, we get no response or a challenge to our authority, and we have no subpoena power or cease and desist authority for these unlicensed entities. In the pawnbroker area, again, primarily unlicensed operations, we've had referrals from alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, U.S. government agency, and referrals from licensed entities as well. And here we had some success. We did a couple investigations, and a couple of folks decided to step up and get licensed, even though we don't have the authority to recover our costs of the investigation or what have you. So that's just kind of a snapshot of, in the past year or so, of some of the issues we're dealing with. again, primarily unlicensed entities is the big problem. But the end goal, I think, as Mr. Tabman, the deputy, testified, is to have a consistent approach to enforcement within the division, since we have so many different programs. It would be make administration of these programs and the legislative requirements much more effective and efficient if we had these authorities.
Thank you. Question for Director Lender. Yes, Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically the same question I asked before is, what's the responsibility of DCPS to go after folks that are supposed to be licensed, and you know, the ability of DCPS to tell them to get licensed or you're out of business? I mean, if they're supposed to be licensed, as we have no authority to make people get licensed?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr.
Or are they not supposed to? They don't have to be licensed, I guess? I don't know. That's the question I had.
Well, again, it's going to vary from industry to industry. But essentially, yes, they should be licensed. In certain cases, we've tried to convince them to get their license, pointing out the requirements in the statute. But there again, we have no enforcement authority to back that threat up. So it's a question of they want to deny our authority. Not much we can do about that.
Well, and Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
You know, I spent a number of years as a licensed contractor, construction contractor, and it didn't seem to me that the Construction Contractors Board had any trouble going after the contractors that were operating without license and insurance and bond. What's the difference between their authority to go after folks that, you know, weren't playing by the same rules I was playing by and your authority to go after folks that are supposed to be licensed? What's the difference?
Chair Metzger, Vice Chair Starr, without knowing their authority, it's a little bit difficult for me to respond, but I'm presuming, which is dangerous, I know, that they have the authority to recover their costs of investigations and such, and so that they can, you know, pursue that avenue and, of course, try and get the individual to comply.
And just a final, Mr. Chair, before we move on this bill, Mr. Chair, I would hope that maybe we get, you know, we've had a lot of anecdotal kind of testimony about, you know, a situation in this community, another one over here, and here's how they turned out. I'd like to have maybe a more concrete look at, if you had some more details and data about, you know, what the department does in enforcement and some... at least some more information about how big of a problem are we really faced with, and how critically important is this bill to what your agency and your responsibilities are to the state. I'd like to have a little bit more concrete information.
Any other questions? Senator Ackerman.
I would support a bill if we just did something for the funeral directors. I think their industry is considerably different from pawnbrokers, credit organizations, collection agencies, and pawnbrokers. I mean, this is the clients of prearranged funeral plans are different, and I can understand where they're coming from, at least from a financial modeling side of business, but this other stuff, I don't know. So I would support if you wanted to break it out and run a funeral bill, but right now I'm uncomfortable why DCBS needs to just carte blanche have authority over all this new area and because of one cease and desist order or something. I'm not comfortable there, but I wouldn't mind doing something for the funeral directors. I think it's a completely different business, different clientele, and everything here is short term except for funeral planning. I guess that's the ultimate long term, but you know, you've got different cash flow requirements in these businesses than you do funeral planning. So
I think what we'll do, Mr. Lander, if you could please. I think we will hold this for a little bit. I'd like to see if we can get some more specificity in some of these other areas, number one.
And I think also it would be helpful for a response to Senator Starr's question maybe about comparing the authority for the CCB and how they're able to keep non-licensed contractors in line as opposed to others in the areas in which you have supervision. I think that would be helpful in giving us greater clarity to see whether this consistency across the board is required or not, and if that is helpful. And I think that would definitely be helpful, as you can tell by the questions from the members. So we will, if you will do that in short order and connect with Teresa Van Winkle on that, that would be very helpful.
Okay.
And then share that with our members before we bring the bill back. Okay?
Okay.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 120. We'll open public hearing on Senate Bill 121. Mr. Lander, I believe I have you on this one as well.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lloyd Lanter. I serve as the administrator of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I appear today to request the committee support for Senate Bill 121. The purpose of this legislation is to upgrade and update the director's enforcement authority with respect to the regulation of franchise sales. The sale of franchise businesses is already regulated in Oregon under Oregon Revised Statute, Chapter 650. No special license or pre-sale registration is currently required, although entities offering franchises must disclose specific information in writing to prospective purchasers. Engaging in fraud in the sales process by either failing to provide the material information about a franchise or making misrepresentation of material facts may result in civil lawsuits by the director or the aggrieved franchisee. This bill would streamline enforcement efforts by the director by providing authority to issue cease and desist orders administratively. The director has existing authority to conduct investigations, issue subpoenas, and take testimony concerning potential franchise law violations. Granting cease and desist authority would complement the director's existing powers and provide for the most cost-effective and prompt form of consumer protection. Many of the other programs within the division already have cease and desist authority, except for those that we just discussed in the previous bill. This form of administratively issued discipline is widely used and poses no special problems or hardships for either the agency or the respondent. By employing the Oregon Administrative Hearings Panel, administrative hearings under this bill would be conducted by a neutral administrative law judge, ensuring fairness to all parties involved. The advantage of cease and desist authority is that it gives the agency the flexibility of bringing enforcement cases without incurring the significant cost in dealing with the frequent delays associated with civil litigation. Preparing for a suit, filing the suit, conducting discovery, and trying even a single civil lawsuit results in the division incurring thousands of dollars in legal fees. On the other hand, bringing a cease and desist action administratively would result in no additional cost to the agency. Vigorous enforcement of the franchise laws, particularly in its anti-fraud provisions, should not be precluded because of high legal fees. Moreover, the significant time involved in trying a lawsuit in circuit court may result in the fraudulent conduct not being stopped and additional victims, primarily small Oregon businesses, from being monetarily harmed. A cease and desist order can be issued and heard by administrative law judge in a more timely manner, ensuring that the violations can be addressed promptly. The bill also gives the director authority to impose financial penalties up to $10,000 for each violation, with a maximum penalty of $50,000 for ongoing violations. These penalties are similar to the penalties that the director can impose in our mortgage lender law, in the Oregon Commodity Code, and the Oregon Securities Law. The remainder of the proposals in the bill are changes that the Legislative Council has suggested to modernize and clarify the language of Oregon franchise laws. They're not intended to make any substantive changes. The bill is fee neutral, and we're not aware of any opposition to the bill, and I would respectfully request that the committee support the bill and send it to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Lanter. Well, I'll save you one question. You know it's coming, so I'll ask you first. Could you give us an example or two of in the security of the franchise area in which your department has confronted the lack of authority to issue an appropriate cease and desist?
We, Chair Metzger, this past year we had one particular case that I recall involved the purchase of a franchise dealing with a pizza oven. And we spent about 200 hours pursuing this. We didn't take it to court because of the time and costs involved. But we spent about 200 hours pursuing this, just using our regulatory jawboning or leverage, whatever you want to call it. And we were successful in getting $75,000 of the $100,000 that the Oregonian had spent on this returned to the investor. We currently have two cases pending, I've been told, on franchise issues, and we get anywhere from 4 to 5 a month that come through. Oregon is a disclosure state. There are 15 states that regulate franchises. Some regulate them as securities offerings where the offering has to be approved up front. Oregon is just simply a disclosure state where if you're going to invest in a franchise, the franchisor has to give you certain information 10 days before you sign the agreement, and that's really what we pursue and enforce, that they make the proper disclosures. That's a little bit of background for you there, I know.
Questions for Mr. Lattner?
So are all the complaints you're getting from out-of-state businesses that are trying to franchise in Oregon, or some of them based in Oregon trying to franchise in Oregon?
Chair Metzger, Senator Atkinson, since Oregon is not a registration state, that's difficult to say. I would have to go back and look at the substance of the complaints to see if they involve companies outside of Oregon or inside. Our focus is primarily on Oregonians who are investing in franchises. We don't register franchises in the state. We're one of the few states that of the 15 that don't. Our, for example, Washington does. They do about 700 registrations a year. But I'd be willing to go back and research the complaints if you. But our primary focus is Oregonians.
Senator Decker.
Thank you. It kind of feels like the people's court, but the whole pizza oven issue, and you said you get 4 or 5 of these a month. I wasn't clear on what the problem was. Did the Oregonian bought a pizza oven or a Pizza Hut?
No, actually, he bought, Chair Metzger, Senator Jacket, he bought a pizza oven. That was being sold. Sold out of a franchise operation out of California.
Just the oven.
Yes, okay. And the individual complained. You know, obviously it wasn't successful. So you know, when things don't go well, who you call? They call us, and we did the initial investigation and did some research into it, and it turned out that the individuals who were selling the franchise didn't make the proper disclosures. They were actually selling another product at the same time to other folks, etc. So the Oregonian investor in this case was very disadvantaged, if you will. And we did not pursue civil action, again, because of the cost here. But through the work of an attorney and the investigators in the division, we were able to get an agreement with the California seller to reimburse the Oregonian for 75 cents on the dollar of his investment.
And that, Mr. Chair, that's pretty typical of the cases is you've got, I'm just trying to read this one clearly. So the individual tried to buy a pizza oven, paid the money, never got the oven.
He actually got the oven.
Oh. Okay, well. Well, what's the problem if he got the oven?
Chair Metzger, Senator Decker, in this case, the issue was the quality of the disclosures that were made to the purchaser.
So that's Mr. Chair, a typical example of what you're doing is helping the Oregonian who's been harmed in some way
Chair Metzger, Senator Decker, correct. That's why we're here. That's why we exist.
You were on the edge of your seat. Did you want to add something to this?
With respect to Mr. Leonard's commission, I just give the committee a little background.
Please restate your name.
Yes, I will. My name is Dave Tapman, Deputy Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. Mr. Chair and Senator Decker, the situation was that the individual in Oregon had purchased the franchise right to use this pizza oven and had the exclusive right to use a certain oven. It was going to be a special oven that allowed for fast-rising pizza dough. It would cut the time of cooking pizzas in half or faster. So he paid a very high franchise fee, as most franchises pay. Every franchisee pays a fee. He paid a high fee. And it turned out that, A, the oven didn't do what it did. Huh. B, their technology didn't exist to the extent they claimed it did. And C, what technology they did have belonged to somebody else. So he was misled into spending $100,000 to have this franchise right. And it just didn't pan out. So much like other frauds that we see within the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, this person put money down, good faith money down, and in return didn't get what he had bargained for.
So, Mr. Chair, who's the judge in that? Are y'all the judge that says this is not the oven that you should have gotten or received?
Mr. Chair and Senator Deckard, we have investigative authority. So when we receive a complaint, what we do is we go in and investigate. And so in this case, this particular statutory framework allows us to issue a subpoena and ask the California company to provide records of information. The allegation from the franchisee, the investor, if you will, said that he wasn't getting what he'd been promised. And so we got documentation from the company to establish whether they had, in fact, delivered what they'd promised or not. When it became apparent to us that they had not promised as they had not delivered as they had promised, then we took the position that they had committed fraud, and we told them we had one of two choices: reimburse the individual, or we would need to go to circuit court and file a lawsuit on behalf of the citizens of Oregon. So we don't act as judge, to answer your question specifically. All we do is act on behalf of Oregonians who file a complaint and conduct an investigation and then act as a party.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. That will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 121 and open a work session on Senate Bill 121. I have a motion on that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move on Senate Bill 121 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 121 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objections? So we're. Anybody in particular would like to carry this bill?
Okay.
Okay, I will carry it. Okay, we'll open up a public hearing now on Senate Bill 83. And we have a plethora of testimony. Paul Clivers, Dan Linsheed, and if I get them wrong, please correct me. I'm sure you will when we get up. Marie Lopez. Why don't we start with those folks coming up.
Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Paul Kluvers. It's Kluvers.
Okay.
And I am here to represent the Structural Engineers Association of Oregon. And we are recommending that Senate Bill 83 be passed. There's a number of reasons for that. One of them is that there's some minor changes in the words that have a fairly significant effect, and reflect an apparent typographical error that was reflected in the bill when it was first submitted in 1999. The change is changing the "and" to "or," and we feel that the change, as it is, or the bill, the law as it's currently written, it provides loopholes that allows certain buildings and structures to bypass the intent of the law. And preserving the intent of the law, we feel, is essential to public safety and serves to protect the resources that are needed to respond to emergencies such as natural or man-made disasters, especially in the event of an earthquake. anyway, as a conclusion, I just urge that this bill be passed.
Great.
Chair Metzger and members of the committee, I'm Mari Lopez, the Executive Secretary of the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying, and I'm here on behalf of the board in support of Senate Bill 83. I'd also like to inform you that a previous board member, Bob Walker, is also present today to further discuss the Senate Bill 83, if I have your permission to have him sit here.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Mr. Walker? It's pretty good. You bring your own introduction. It's pretty good.
Well, I was late.
Mr. Chairman and Senators, I was on the board when this bill was originally passed, and I was also on the board when the error was discovered, which was about a year ago. And essentially, it changes the type of engineer that's going to work on a building. It has nothing to do with the fact that a design professional is not going to provide the services. It's just whether or not a structural engineer provides the engineering for an essential facility that's of a certain size. The building code, state building code, requires that all buildings larger than 4,000 square feet or more than 20 feet in height have a design professional. That's either an engineer or an architect. And the architect's law requires an architect to be involved in all buildings that are over 4,000 square feet and 20 feet in height. And the engineer's law actually says that all engineering is to be done by an engineer, whether no matter the size of the building. However, our AG, when I was on the board, made a determination that since the architect's law includes an exception, that would also include the engineer's law because it's a similar product and laws are passed to be worked together as a one conclusion. So they said the engineers also would have to follow the exception the same as the architects. So that means an essential facility smaller than 4,000 square or larger than 4,000 square feet and 20 feet in height would have at least an architect, and the architect could retain the services of an engineer. Now, Senate Bill 83 just defines what type of engineer that has to be. And the original law was passed with the intent that the smaller buildings could be done by other engineers other than a structural. That would be mechanical, civil, any kind of engineering. And because there was an and put in there instead of an or, it made it larger than 4,000 square feet and more than 20 foot in height. So that means you could have a 4,000 square foot building that was 40 stories and it still would be exempt from the structural law. Or it could be a 100,000 square foot building and less than 20 feet in height and be exempt. And that was not the original intent. So if I can answer questions, I will be happy to do so.
Why don't we have our other testimony and then we'll do that. Or do you have anything to add there?
Senator Metzger, Chair of Members, I am a member of the board. And
please state your name for the record.
Dan Lynchheim, and I'm a surveyor for Yamhill County and a member of the board, and I filled the position that Mr. Walker used to hold on the board as the Rules and Regulations Committee Chair. And so this was, as Bob has said, this kind of a housekeeping thing, and don't know if there's any opposition or not, but it looks like it's going to clean up the record, make this easier to administer from the board's perspective.
Have we had any skyscrapers attempted to be designed by mechanical engineers in the meantime?
We have had mechanical engineers do structural engineering, but I don't know that we have any skyscrapers.
Well, I have, first of all, before we go on, is there any questions for these gentlemen first? Senator Starr.
Thank you. This bill only applies to what's defined as essential facilities. That's correct?
Senator Starr, that's correct.
So hospitals and government buildings and things like that.
Well, essential facilities are defined in the building code as those that need immediate response to disasters. So that would be fire stations, police stations, call centers. It doesn't really say a hospital, I believe.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
The essential facility means hospitals, medical facilities, fire, police station, tanks, other structures containing housing for basically putting out fires, emergency vehicle shelters, structures, equipment, and emergency preparedness centers, standby power generating equipment for essential facilities and structures and equipment, and government communication centers. So that's the statute. So that's your understanding of what they were talking about, of those kinds of facilities. It doesn't apply to anything beyond
that. That's correct.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you. Now I have Jennifer Gilbert signed up to testify.
Have Maria introduce her, too. It's a nice touch.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Gilbert, and I am the Executive Assistant for the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying, and I am also here on behalf of the board in support of Senate Bill 83.
Okay. Well, any questions for Jennifer?
Yes, Senator Decker. Just one, Mr. Chair, and I should know this, but the board has all the respective professions represented on the board, civil engineers, the spectrum that would want be interested in an issue like this.
Correct.
Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. I have no one else set to testify on Senate Bill 83. Is there anyone in the audience with one last opportunity? Okay. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 83, open a work session on Senate Bill 83. Have a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 83 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 83 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection? Okay. Senator Starr, would you carry that one?
Sure.
Okay, Senator Starr. Now, we got one bill left, folks. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 86. And I have a funny feeling we're having a very similar cast of characters. Our introduction, designated introductor, and Dan and Jennifer are all here. So I guess, Murray, we'll begin with you, I think.
This is basically a housekeeping rule, statute change as well. Currently, on exempt buildings, registered engineers are not required to stamp their documents or designs, and by changing this Senate Bill 86. It would require the engineers to stamp their documents. We would have the, regulate the practice. They wouldn't be exempt from their own from the engineers' laws.
Okay. Let's go on to Jennifer and then Dan.
Chair Metzger, do you have any questions?
I actually do, but I'll wait and see what Dan has to say here.
Chair Metzger, I'm just here to support this bill.
Okay.
It's come through the rules and rules.
Well, then, if someone could help me, then tell me about the purpose for that in terms of stamping those work. What are we trying to accomplish here, and what is the issue that we're really facing? I mean, I know what it does, but give me the purpose for it.
Right now, would it be structural engineers?
Just any engineers.
I'm a surveyor, sir, so bear with me. And this is all fairly new to me, too.
You have to stamp your thing, surveyors. I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. These people are exempted for this one, the significant structures, from assigning or affixing their seal and signature to these documents. And this would bring them into the fold so that we would have some authority over them. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. I think what you're trying to say is it makes sure that you have a verification that has gone through the engineer, that individual who is licensed to perform that work. I guess I'm a little surprised, knowing, especially with land surveyors, that's happened for a long time, that there was an exemption there in the first place. Does anybody have any idea why it was?
I don't know the history, no.
I don't know when... when this significant structures law was put into effect, and that's when this loophole apparently occurred.
Well, actually, I guess that could be the answer to our question, because I think our previous testimony was that the law was passed in 99, so that may have been part of that. So, because I know it's generally done. Questions from the committee on the engineering stamp?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Starr.
I guess I'm having a little bit of a challenge here. If I look at the front of the from the front of the bill, it doesn't look like it has much changes in statute. But in the back of the bill, starting line 18, except as provided in this subsection, that talks about a person, that lists a number of dwellings, single family residential, farm building, structure used. Basically any building that you would build as relates to a single family residential building or farm building, including but not limited to garages, barns, sheds, shelter used for housing of domestic animals or livestock. So does this mean that in order this doesn't somehow require that if somebody's going to build one of these buildings that they'd have to get an engineer stamp on the plans to build it? It would just say that if a registered engineer happened to design the buildings, they'd have to stamp it.
Correct, Chair Metzger and Senator Starr. Yes.
I guess what's the problem? Why do we need? What's the problem that this bill is the solution for?
Senator Metzger, Senator Starr. Basically, we have no authority to sanction any engineer who would, let's say, do shoddy workmanship on an exempt structure. We have this type of structure, and so we're just trying to bring them into the fold, so to speak, so that we would have some sanction authority. That doesn't mean that the other people who could, under your scenario, do the same type of work without a license, that doesn't grant us any sanctioning authority for them. In the same sense that when we talk about surveyors writing legal descriptions, surveyors have to stamp that legal description. But other people, lawyers, for example, title people, they can write legal descriptions all day long and not stamp it. This just brings this particular exempt structure under so that those people have to sign those if they're registrants. Does that make sense?
I guess.
It sounds to me like it's more of a professional consistency within your own organization, is to make sure that you don't have people that are who are licensed engineers who decide to do things on the side, so to speak, and maybe below certain standards and then meet certain standards when they want to. I mean, is that too simplistic, or am I off base on that?
I think you're right. It brings it into a conformity. It's more of a conformity within the profession, within the licensure itself, so that we're allowed the authority to actually sanction and regulate these exempted, the people who are designing these exempted structures. Our Assistant Attorney General has looked this over and actually came up with verbiage, I believe. So.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair,
yes,
yesterday I got the thrill of doing piranhas, and today we're doing stamping for engineering. So I just have to ask, 200 hours to chase a $100,000 pizza oven, if you were doing that, would you stamp it? I'm sorry, I'm going nuts.
Chair Metzger, Senator Atkinson.
I'm going crazy.
I didn't pay all that much attention to freedom of testimony. I'm sorry.
I've been welling up inside me for an hour now.
Very good question.
Is this, the amount of time we're spending, is this really, really important? I mean, to require all this time?
Senator Metzger, Senator Atkinson, we're doing this so that we're consistent with the architect's law. Currently, the architects regulate and the architects that stamp exempt buildings. So,
okay, are we going to hear from the architects too? Aren't we? We're going to hear from the architects.
We could if you would like. They haven't.
Yeah, might as well. Piranhas and stamps.
We're in recess for a moment.
Okay.
And Murray, you can help with this with Teresa. Let's get a bit more clarity about the importance of this and some of the other professionals that are involved in the organization, and have a bit more clarity from them. I think that would be helpful for the committee before we move forward on that. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 86, and is there anything else to come before the committee at this time? If not, then we are adjourned.
No problem.
understand.